This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Good afternoon, everybody. Happy, happy little Friday. It's 12 minutes after 5 o'clock in Central Virginia. I'm Coy Barefoot. This is Charlottesville Right Now. It's News Radio 1070 WINA. It's about 64 degrees here in God's country. I hope you're doing well. Thanks for joining me. The phone number to the studio is 977-1070. I want you to write that down and remember it, because I want to hear from you this hour as we chat with the Republican nominee for governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, live in studio. He is the former Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia and now the Republican candidate for governor of this great Commonwealth, and he joins me live in studio right here on Rose Hill Drive. It's good to see you. How are you?
Thanks, Coy. It's usually long distance through the telephone, but
that's
nice
right.
To be with you.
Yeah, I usually have you right here in the earphones. It is great to see you. I'm glad you're here. And before we go any further, I have to thank you, because I was saying in the first hour before you got here that when I started this program in early 2006, one of the first places I went was to your office, and I talked with your folks, and we all talked, and you were the first person I asked to be a regular guest on my program, a regular monthly guest to join me on the phone and tell us what's going on in the Attorney General's office and your perspective on politics and policy, and you said yes without hesitating. Absolutely, we'd love to do that. So I want to thank you.
I knew you were going places.
Yeah. Sure thing. Well, it looks like I'm not the one going places, but perhaps you, as you run for the governor's mansion this year. Very exciting. How's it going?
Well, it's a terrific honor to be considered to be the governor of this incredible state of Virginia. As you know, the first two governors were Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Henry, two incredibly great Virginians. And, you know, for me, a middle-class kid from Northern Virginia, oldest of five, that learned the lessons from an Air Force officer dad about life, and now possibly being able to ascend to this high office is really extraordinary. I spent all my life in public service, pretty much as an Army officer, a prosecutor, legislator, attorney general, worked in business for a while, but I've always liked being a public servant, serving people, fixing problems, getting things done. I really like policy and finding the right ways to get things done at the lowest cost for the citizens. So this would be a terrific opportunity, and I'm certainly working as hard as I can to convince a couple million voters to come my way.
What do you think it is about public service, especially elected office, that most Virginians don't know about or don't get, that you, having done it for so many years, you live it, you know it, and you perhaps wish more people understood? Is there one thing that Virginians don't know about serving an elected office? or a misconception?
Yeah, there's probably a lot. I mean, it's an enormous privilege for me. If you get probably a lot of credit for things that you don't deserve, and you get a lot of blame for things that you're not directly responsible for. But I tell you, the thing that I like is there's enormous satisfaction. As Attorney General in the last 4 years, we actually were able to work very well with the Kane administration, fixed a lot of problems on everything from mental health to homeland security, settling cases with the Virginia Tech, reducing gang violence. And there are any number of things, and it was because we got people together, analyzed problems, analyzed what the right policies were, put them into place, and got results. I think people may not understand that most people in public service, I think, are in it for the right reasons. They want to get solutions. They like working together. And unfortunately, in part driven by the media, all you hear about is the conflict, as opposed to the people that cooperate and actually work hard and like to feel good at the end of the day they got things done.
And that is probably one thing that most Virginians don't know when it comes to actual policy that gets passed in Richmond. The vast majority of stuff is little argument and total bipartisanship.
Yeah,
but the headlines cover that small minority of things that the parties disagree on. Or even within parties.
Well, it's the old mantra, conflict sells, bad news sells. you know, writing a great story about how everybody got along and sang Kumbaya on a vote 100-0, it just lacks some pizzazz, which is very unfortunate because many of those things, Coy, the reason they pass so overwhelmingly is that through the committee system that Mr. Jefferson designed, a lot of the political issues, the regional issues, urban, suburban issues all get worked out in the committee. So that by the time it hits the floor of the House of Delegates or the Senate, there have been compromises. The problems have been ironed out. And most people on a bipartisan basis say, yeah, this is good for the citizens of Virginia. Let's work together. And you're absolutely right. 80% of the bills ultimately either get killed because they're bad or they get the problems get worked out and they get passed overwhelmingly.
We're talking with Bob McDonnell. He is the Republican nominee for governor. And the phone lines are open if you've got a question or a comment at 977-1070. I know Mr. McDonald would love to hear from you. It's 977-1070. Hank is waiting on line one. Hank, you're on with Bob McDonald. You go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I was wondering, if elected governor, what do you see as the one primary thing in this economy and with all the various issues? What would be your dream or vision? What would be the one thing that you would like to see yourself successfully accomplish during your tenure as governor?
Well, unquestionably right now, as you, and you pointed out, people concerned about the economy and the fiscal issues from job creation to government spending. For me, I'd like to be able to dramatically expand opportunity and free enterprise in Virginia. And to me, that means jobs. We're at a 7.2% unemployment rate right now. Many, many people are concerned about losing their job or have lost their job or know somebody that's in jeopardy of losing their job or concerned about their college graduate from UVA getting that first job. So I have said I want to be a jobs governor. I want to be able to expand small business through cutting regulations and faster permitting. I want to bring more industry to Virginia, particularly film and tourism production. I want to expand the governor's opportunity fund, and I had a lengthy press conference this morning with the lieutenant governor outlining numerous changes in our governor's opportunity fund and new tax credits to woo new business to Virginia. I've said that I want Virginia to be the energy capital of the East Coast, to use our coal and natural gas resources in Southwest Virginia, new nuclear power plants in Virginia, get them permitted faster, offshore drilling 50 miles offshore that can be done economically friendly and put all that money into green energy research and transportation. I'd like to be known as the energy governor and consequently the jobs governor. And there's any number of other things to expanding our port in Hampton Roads, our spaceport out in Wallops Island. All these things will help to promote economic development and growth. And the reason is this. Not only are we in a tough economy, but the more that I can get the private sector to be strong and provide opportunity and hopes and dreams for our citizens, the less government's got to spend, meaning the less taxes we need to be able to provide the big safety net and the money for prisons if free people can provide jobs for one another. So that's my goal.
Great. Hank, appreciate it. Got a phone line open at 977-1070. We're talking with Bob McDonnell, candidate for governor, and he is live in studio talking with you at 977-1070. Lynn is online too. Lynn, you're on with Bob McDonnell. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Coy. It's good to talk to you.
Hi, Lynn.
Mr. McDonnell, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Lynn.
I was wondering if you could comment just briefly on your education views and on funding and the No Child Left Behind mandate.
Sure. Well, that's three big ones right there. I mean, I've raised five children here in Virginia, my wife and I, and we're very blessed that all of them have gotten a good education. They've all graduated from Virginia public schools, except for my twin boys that'll graduate next year, a couple of them graduating from Virginia colleges. And I remember that old commercial when I was growing up that said, to get a good job, you need a good education. It's still true today. In fact, it may be more true today with the increasing specialization in our economy. So here's what I've said. In K-12, a couple things we need to do. We need more money to go to the classroom and less into bureaucracy. We need to turn around the 72 schools that are currently rated as unaccredited. I think that's embarrassing in Virginia that we've got 72 schools not fully accredited. I want a turnaround specialist to be hired to be reporting directly to the Secretary of Education, to go in there like they do in private business and work with the school boards and get those problems turned around. I agree that we need significant school reform, and President Obama's right on two things that he's announced. One, we need more charter schools in Virginia to provide real choice and opportunity, particularly for young people in inner cities like Petersburg. And secondly, we ought to have performance pay for teachers to be able to tie performance with achievement, and I'm going to be a champion for both of those. And finally, I think we need to do a lot better job in promoting science and engineering, technology, math, healthcare, some of these sciences where we're starting to lag behind other states and worse, other countries. Pacific Rim countries are really advocating the hard sciences, and it's important for national security, for our military, for our leadership in the tech sector that we've got growing in Northern Virginia, that we develop a lot more people in those areas. Just to give you a for instance, we've got probably the largest concentration of private nuclear capacity of any state in the country with Dominion and the United States Navy and Northrop Grumman and Areva and some of these other companies, but they can't find enough civil and nuclear engineers to do what we need to do. So you just saw that there was a partnership between Areva and Lynchburg and the University of Virginia to create a work-study program to train engineers to work at Areva while they're working on their engineering degree at UVA. It's a great idea, and it's an example of the kind of things that we need to do to promote the Virginia economy. So I want to find more of those public-private partnerships to be able to meet the economic needs of Virginia. I've got some other ideas on higher education. I rolled out a comprehensive higher education reform plan 2 months ago that basically calls for 100,000 new degrees over and above what we're doing now by the year 2025, and to put a lot of those new degrees into science and technology and engineering and math. Have our community colleges be the epicenter for workforce development. They're regional. They know what the economic needs are of their regions. That, I think, will help get more young people into college at a lower cost.
We're talking with Bob McDonnell, Republican nominee for governor. Lynn, thank you. Great question. She did ask about No Child Left Behind.
Yes.
And I'm curious your thoughts about federal efforts out of Washington to tinker with what the states are doing. I had always thought that the Virginia bar was set higher than what the federal bar is.
It is. I am not a big supporter of No Child Left Behind. It might have a noble goal. And frankly, this was the Republicans that ushered this in some 5 or 6 years ago. But normally when the federal government creates a huge new bureaucracy, particularly in something like education, which has generally been the province of the states to do well, they create enormous new bureaucracies and red tape and impediments, and frankly, a lot of money going to central record keeping and administration and bureaucracy that really ought to go to the states. I would have much preferred that they put a lot of that money into block grants and give it to the states. Because, Corey, you're absolutely right. What we did in the mid-90s, and late 90s, actually, with our standards of learning and our high standards of academics that we put into the standards of learning in Virginia and then the testing that went with it. We actually had great reforms in Virginia that I thought were already higher than what they were mandating. But that's the problem, whether it's a Democrat or Republican administration. If you want to have a one-size-fits-all program, whether it's in business or healthcare or education like No Child Left Behind, it generally creates a lot of bureaucracy without a lot of results. And so we have been trying for years now to get ourselves out from some of the more egregious mandates of No Child Left Behind. A lot of the teachers and superintendents don't like what it's doing to Virginia.
Are those efforts working?
Yeah, some of them we've gotten some relief, but a lot of them they won't let us out of. And so it is overall a policy that I don't think has worked particularly well in Virginia. We had good standards. What we could use maybe is some block grant money to allow us to do what we're already doing well, but not all the record keeping and reporting and other egregious mandates that come out of the federal government.
We're talking with Bob McDonnell. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. Mary, waiting patiently on line one. Mary, you're on with Bob McDonnell. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I enjoy the show.
And hi, Mary.
It's interesting hearing all of your ideas, and I like a lot of them.
Mary? Oh, I think we lost her. Let's go to Margo on line two. Mary, give us a call back when you have a good connection. Margo, go right ahead.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Hi, Margo.
I know you're not for cap and trade, correct?
No, I've spoken strongly against it.
But what would you do for the environment?
I believe that conservation is a conservative value, and we need to be good conservators of the environment. In fact, there's an article in the Virginia Constitution that requires that we protect the environment. So I've said a couple things. One, I've made a proposal a couple of months ago to preserve 400,000 new acres of open space land in Virginia for hunting, for fishing, for keep it free from development. This is something I feel strongly about, and I'll be a governor that'll get that done. When it comes to reducing the carbon footprint, There's a number of things that we can do. One, we can put new incentive money into reducing SOx and NOx and CO2 emissions from our coal plants. There are a number of things going on now with carbon sequestration and carbon capture to pump CO2 back into coal seams. That's worked in the southeast part of the United States that I think holds enormous promise. GE has actually got plants like that that are now working with minimal, well, some government subsidies, but it's still a lot cheaper than some alternative energy plants. So I think we ought to do that. Secondly, we ought to move to things that don't have a carbon footprint. Natural gas, an extraordinary source of energy for southwest Virginia. We've got hundreds of years of supply of natural gas. It has virtually no carbon footprint. We ought to expand the use of natural gas. Same with nuclear. Nuclear has no carbon footprint, and yet we put all these impediments into building nuclear power. France has 80% nearly of their power is nuclear. We've got 23% in America. We need to speed up nuclear permitting and processing, cut down the cost of getting it done. We're about to, we're still 3 years away from a new nuclear plant at Lake Anna, but I'm going to do everything I can to help get that
built. Would you support an offshore wind farm that which Delaware, I believe, is now pursuing with great gusto? It always seemed to me that Virginia would be one of the great leaders in that kind of thing with the beautiful coastline that we have and the steady winds coming in there. Is that something that you would see that the state should invest in?
Well, I'm going to be a strong supporter, first of all, of offshore drilling for oil and natural gas. We've got the ability to do that as the first state on the eastern seaboard in 2011, so I'm going to make that a strong proposal. Part of my overall comprehensive energy plan. Secondly, though, I have been in touch with leaders in Virginia Beach who are looking at a rather substantial wind farm off the coast. The problems right now is whether it's those things are commercially practicable. You know, the wind doesn't blow regularly. You don't store the wind energy very well at this point. There are long transmission line issues. But to the degree that we can put money into research and development for alternatives like wind and solar and biomass, I'm 100%
to overcome some of those challenges.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think over time the engineering and the technology is going to get there to make some of those things commercially practical. There's only been a handful of places in the country that wind has really worked in Palm Springs and a couple places in Delaware. There are some work being done right now to look at Virginia Beach. I will continue to work with Virginia Beach officials. I live there. I know those folks well. And if it makes sense and we can generate a low per kilowatt hour that's obviously environmentally friendly, we'll do it.
We're talking with Bob McDonald, the Republican nominee for governor. He's live in studio taking your calls at 977-1070. Margot, thank you so much for joining the conversation. We're going to take a quick break now for local news and weather and continue this conversation in about 5 minutes. The phone lines are open at 977-1070 for your questions and comments for the former Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia and the Republican nominee for Governor Bob McDonnell. He's live in studio. Let's rejoin our conversation with Bob McDonnell, and I know he would love to hear from you at 977-1070. In the last half hour, you mentioned the port, and I'd like to bring that up as a segue into talking about transportation, because folks need to understand that what happens at the port and the future success of this port, the potential of which is amazing, is totally tied up with transportation, because those ships are getting bigger and bigger, so more product is being brought in, but then you can bring it in, but then how do you get it off the ship and to the Walmart or the Target or to the store? And that's a real challenge for the folks down at the port, is they'd love to grow and have, you know, arguably could be the biggest and the best port on the East Coast right here in Virginia. But getting the stuff from the truck to the store is proving quite challenging because it's such a bottleneck down there in Hampton Roads.
You've accurately described the challenges and the asset there, the port. I mean, it's a gem. And I think what people don't always know is that the revenues from the port, COI, it's a statewide port, so the revenues go into the general fund, meaning it helps all of the state by what comes through there.
They make money coming and going. You know,
sending
lumber out to China to turn into furniture to come back into Target. You know, the port, the Virginia, makes money both ways.
Both ways. We'd rather have it going out, but either way, we make money for the state. We've got when the Craney Island terminal is done within the next 7 or 8 years, and the Panama Canal is widened in the, by 2014 or so, there will be the ability to just about triple the amount of freight that can come in and out of Hampton Roads. We'll be at or larger than New York. So that's the kind of potential that we've got. But you're absolutely right. We need the road network, which is Route 460, and maybe portions of that third crossing to be done in Hampton Roads, so that all of the truck and rail traffic that's coming in and out, that would come in and out to service that port and the APM port in Portsmouth, will be sufficient in order to handle the increase.
And so rail is not always part. Rail is not always the solution, because as I understand it, and has been explained to me on port tours, inside of 300 miles, product wants to go by rail, just by truck, just economically speaking.
That's right.
It doesn't make sense to put it on a rail if you're going to send it within 300 miles.
That's right. I mean, truck's obviously more flexible. You go right to the destination. Rail, you got to go to a railhead, and then you have to unload it onto a truck and move it somewhere else. So that's about right. But for the long term, shipping goods to the Midwest or other places like that, rail is a great possibility. And that's why this Heartland Corridor from Chicago to Norfolk, that's about completed, is another way to really increase the use of Hampton Roads as opposed to New York or Bayonne, New Jersey, or some other place.
Right, right. So what is the solution? I mean, if you take office next January, what do we do as a community? And I look at Virginia as a community. What do we do about transportation, especially when we're facing, you know, one of the worst economies in decades?
I think you got to think outside the box. You got to be creative. And more importantly, you got to have leadership that's going to make transportation a priority. We've just about doubled the budget of Virginia, even with these tough economic times over the last 10 years, Coy, 30% faster than the rate of growth in population and inflation. I cut my budget in the Attorney General's office 14% in the last year with some tough choices, and I don't think we really missed a beat in service. So that's the kind of leadership you need in the governor's office. We need more money for transportation, more money for higher education operations. Those will be priorities for me. So I'm going to propose a series of reforms, which will include everything from more public-private partnerships, more congestion pricing and market-based solution, getting the $3 billion in bonds we approved 2 years ago. Not a dime of that's been issued. We need to get that rolling and accelerated. We've got some additional bonds I'd like to consider floating. We need to do things like offshore drilling and put that money into transportation, special tax districts around the port to put that money into transportation, and we'll have some other ideas. We need to use technology. Just synchronizing lights, for instance, on Route 7 will save us a lot of headache. I want to be able to lay the foundations for high-speed rail from Northern Virginia to Hampton Roads, going through Richmond, take some of that traffic off of 64 and off of 95. There are a number of things like that that I think we will put together to use creativity in this tough economy and find ways to get the roads built.
Now, Virginia hasn't had an increase in its statewide gas tax since, what, 86 under Governor Gerald Baliles.
That's correct.
Is that something you would oppose or veto?
I won't support that. Not right now. We've got, I mean, I don't intend to support
and
any
And I say
tax
veto,
increase.
Assuming it would get through the General Assembly. Who knows?
Well, it's been proposed in the Senate and has always been killed in the House. There's a couple things with the gas tax. One is, as you pointed out, in 86, it was a flat 17 cents, 17.5 cents it was imposed, was an index to inflation. If that had been put in place as just a percentage of the overall revenue, then it would have increased over time, but that's not what's happened. People are very concerned about the price of gas right now. We're getting that unusual summer bump. Oil's up to now $70 plus a barrel again. People are concerned about what's going on in Iraq and Iran and Russia and Venezuela, places where we get a lot of our oil. With those situations being unstable, people are concerned about rising oil prices. I think what we do need to look at, though, long term, is we're going to have more efficient vehicles, more fuel-efficient vehicles. CAFE standards are changed at the federal level. We're going to have alternative fuels like natural gas, hydrogen, liquefied coal, electricity. So long term, the amount of reliance on the gas tax is going to go down, but because of these other fuels. So I do think we need to have a conversation about long term, with gas tax revenues going down, what do we do in order to support road infrastructure? And that's something that I will address in the first year with a panel of experts to look at how the changing nature of fueling automobiles means a change in how we fund transportation.
So a gas tax isn't the solution in 2009 that it may have been arguably by some in the 1980s.
Right. I've not supported that at this time, but I will have a plan that will be realistic, that will meet the needs of our state. And we'll say transportation is a priority, and let's spend and invest that way.
We're talking with the Republican nominee for governor here in the great Commonwealth of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, and the phone lines are open. If you've got a question, 977-1070. Randolph is on line one. Randolph, thanks for the call. You're on with Bob McDonnell. Go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much. Nice to make your acquaintance over the telephone.
Hi, Randolph.
Hi. My question is, this has to do with gasoline tax, also has to do with all sin taxes, such as the tax we have in tobacco and alcohol. Why can't we, like we do with gasoline tax, which basically goes to build roads and other highway projects, why can't we have sin taxes like those that are put on tobacco and those that are put on alcohol go directly to one of the largest items of expenses for the Commonwealth, which is Medicare, the state share of Medicare and Medicaid? Alcohol and tobacco causes lots of injuries and causes lots of deaths and causes lots of illnesses, as we know. So since that's the largest line item, why can't it just simply go into the Medicare and Medicaid? And what do you think about sin taxes, and shouldn't they be going to the sin itself as opposed to, say, into the general fund? I'll let you talk.
Well, that's a good analysis, because those taxes do, by and large, go directly to the general fund, which, of course, then indirectly gets appropriated, for instance, for the state share of Medicaid and for other health care needs. So indirectly, it does help proportionately for those things. I would say that tobacco has been the favorite spot for people that want to raise taxes to be able to levy new taxes, because 80% of the people don't smoke, and so the amount of the cigarette tax has just about doubled in the last couple of years in Virginia. And the federal government just passed, a new tax that brings the federal tax to $1.05 per pack, just a federal tax. So it's about $1.45 or so, or $1.35 per pack right now, just the tax component of every pack of cigarettes. We do have, though, all the tobacco settlement money that we got from the 1998 settlement with the tobacco companies. All of that money goes to a tobacco settlement fund, and about half of that money goes directly to health care purposes. So we have done that with the proceeds of the lawsuit.
Where I'm coming from is that the taxpayer, say you're a smoker, you probably don't mind paying the cigarette tax as long as you think it might be going for your own health care 40 years from now when you develop lung cancer, as opposed to it just going into some other expense item. I think if it's a sin tax, it should go for the sin. What do you say to that specifically?
We don't have a lot of
going to health care.
Randolph, thank you so much for the call. We don't have a lot of dedicated taxes, like the tax on this is going to be spent on X is going to be spent on Y. The state doesn't have a lot of those kind of things.
Well,
do we?
Actually, of the total revenues in the budget, about half of them are dedicated. That's why they're called non-general funds, because you can't spend them for any purpose. They're designated for a particular purpose. And that's taxes like a gas tax, which goes to transportation, portions of the sales tax. A penny out of every sales tax is a non-general fund, because that goes to transportation. A lot of federal money is non-general fund and has to go to specific expenditures. So only about half of the revenues that we bring in are actually going to the general fund. So it's more than you'd think, Corey. It's about evenly split.
Okay. Well, what about Randolph's point that we changed the law so that these sin taxes address the sins or the results of the sins, and as you answer that question, feel free to talk too about your thoughts on healthcare reform, which we spoke about yesterday on this program at length with Dr. Tim Garson of the University of Virginia, and what possible healthcare reform might mean for Virginia as well.
It could be done. Randolph's point is correct, that there's certainly a nexus between the activity or the behavior of drinking or smoking and perhaps the additional need for health care, at least certainly in the smoking area. If you drink in moderation, certainly people can never have any health problems. But you do that, you take the money away from the general fund, and then you've got less money available for all the general fund purposes, which is education and higher education and public safety and all those things. So it really is more of a fiscal discussion as opposed to his correct point of the nexus. I would simply say that because it does go to the general fund, and because general fund monies do go to support healthcare purposes, that indirectly a fair portion of those monies do go to healthcare. Now, healthcare overall, there are some significant things going on with the Kennedy bill up in the Congress to look at federalizing a significant portion of the healthcare system. My personal opinion is we've got the greatest healthcare system in the world. Even those countries in Europe and Canada that have socialized or nationalized healthcare systems, when they have people that want to not wait in line like they have to do in those socialized medicine systems, they come to the United States. So I think to federalize healthcare, even though we do have a small percentage relatively of the people who are uninsured, not by choice, and even though the costs are something that are of a concern, that for us to layer this whole new federal bureaucracy into our healthcare system and take incentives out of it for physicians and nurses and practitioners to be the best they can be is not the right thing to do, and it's probably not going to be overall good for Virginia citizens. I do think to reform healthcare, in part, what we need to do is we need a lot more focus on prevention. We need to have a lot more ability to cover preventive services because there's four or five chronic diseases, everything from obesity to diabetes and others, that are contributing immensely to the cost of healthcare in the country. And if we were able to focus on prevention for all citizens, diet and exercise and nutraceuticals and things like that, we could ratchet down the healthcare costs at the back end. We also ought to expand individual savings account and pooling of interests for small businesses and individuals to be able to tap into lower cost health insurance for them so that they can make better choices about how they want to have themselves covered.
And that money going towards prevention, you think the insurance companies are waking up and realizing that, hey, if we spend a little bit now, we won't have to spend as much later on?
Absolutely they are. And but the problem is there's not a lot of those benefits that are covered, as you can tell. And there's accountability issues and so forth with, are you really using the service? But I think that most in the healthcare field right now would tell you that the dose of prevention is worth a lot more on the back end with the reduced chronic diseases, which really ratchet up the healthcare costs in the country.
Yeah. Now, I've heard that Medicaid and Medicare is like a ticking time bomb for state budgets. That talk about that a little bit, about what we could be looking at if something isn't done.
Well, Medicaid, which is the program that funds indigent care and certain types of disability care, is a 50-50 state federal match. Medicare, of course, is the program for seniors. When you're over 65 or over 62 with a disability or other, that's the federal program, solely federally funded out of the FICA taxes that you pay out of your paycheck every month. Medicaid funding for the indigent has been either the first or second fastest growing budget item in all of the Virginia budget. It's grown by anywhere, I think, about $1.1 billion over the last 6 or 7 years or decade in Virginia. So it is a substantial increase in costs, and we've got to do a better job finding ways to manage that Medicaid population better. And I think prevention is a big part of it. Pilot programs, maybe with some co-pays to have a little bit more accountability from the Medicaid population. But I just think we've got to find what are the things that are really ratcheting up those costs. And frankly, a part of it is people that are using Medicaid services, using the emergency room as their primary care provider. It's the most expensive place to deliver health care. We've got to find a lot better ways to direct people and incentivize people to use their primary care provider, use preventive services, and so forth, which will reduce the cost of Medicaid in the long term.
My guest is Bob McDonald, the Republican nominee for governor. Let's go back to the phones. Jonathan is on line one. Jonathan, thanks for the call. You're on with Bob McDonald. Go right ahead.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Jonathan.
I just wanted to ask if you were aware of the movement across the country for a lot of states to and governors to try to sort of reinstate the 10th Amendment with the federal government, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, Jonathan, I couldn't agree with that movement anymore. As your listeners know, Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution basically says there's about 8 or 9 limited bits of authority for the federal government. And the 10th Amendment says basically that everything that's not outlined for the federal government to do in Article 1, Section 8 is reserved to the states and the people respectively. It's the brilliance of Mr. Jefferson and the rest of our founders to put this system of federalism in place where the federal government's got limited duties and the state government's got the rest of the duties. Mr. Jefferson himself said that the states ought to be the laboratories of democracy because it was government closest to the people, and the government closest to the people governs best. So I have thought, my view as a state leader and someone who aspires to be governor is that the Congress and the federal courts have trampled on the 10th Amendment for about 60 years. There's very little that the courts won't let the federal government do. If I have anything to do with it, I will join. And this is a concern of Democrat and Republican governors and attorneys general about the tremendous successes of Republicans and Democrats in Congress in trampling on the 10th Amendment. And we believe that we can do a lot of things better in the states and that we don't need. And that's why I've stood up against bills like cap and trade, which will double our electricity costs, card check, which will take away the secret ballot, unfunded mandates in the stimulus bill, and things like that that are a federal intrusion into what the states and the private sector ought to be doing. So he couldn't be any more right. I agree with both Democrat and Republican governors that we've got to breathe new life into the 10th Amendment, into our federal system, or else, the states are just going to be provinces of the federal government. That's not what our founders envisioned.
Bob McDonald, the Republican nominee for governor. Jonathan, thank you for the call. You have 110 days left.
That's right.
Thank you for being here, and we'll hope to see you again before the election. Maybe we can get you back in here. Would look forward to that. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Coy. Always great to be on your show, and go Hoos.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.